next case for argument today is number 044115, Jeffrey Atterbury against Leonard Sherman. Mr. Baker.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is James Baker. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of Mr. Atterbury. This case came before the district court as a procedural due process claim arising out of Mr. Atterbury's reassignment from a management level position at the Department of Professional Regulation to an entry level investigator position in March of 2000. During the summary judgment proceeding, the district court made three conclusions. The first two were that Mr. Atterbury had demonstrated the existence of material issues of fact, that he had been deprived of a property interest and had no post-deprivation process. The third, however, was that it concluded Mr. Atterbury could not overcome the defense of qualified immunity presented by the defendants. And that's the focus of our appeal. The starting point in any type of qualified immunity analysis is an examination of the relevant facts taken from a perspective most favorable to the non-movement.
Mr. Baker, I think we could jump ahead, because under the Saucier against Katz structure, you first have to ask, from that perspective, was there a constitutional violation? It seems like your client got past that hurdle, and it was the second part. Was it clearly enough established that a reasonable public official should know about it? And that's where the district court finds that although there are precedents around, the Supreme Court has called for a fairly precise level of factual similarity. They don't require, you know, something like everybody has to have due process, and then you have to figure that out. And what I'm concerned with is the fact that the Supreme Court in Baltimore and Gilbert against Homer seems to be saying, if you suspend somebody with pay, you can protect yourself as a public employer. Now, this wasn't a suspension with pay. It was a reassignment to a very low position with pay. But do you think that why should a reasonable public official have known that they couldn't reassign to something that wasn't just make work, the reviewing of the old videos, but would really work, albeit way below the man's qualifications?
If I might answer that question by referring to what the district court actually said, and this appears at page 31 of the district court's decision, where it was referring to the cases we cited to the court concerning qualified immunity. And the court said, and I'm quoting, as of March 24, 2000, an employee who was reassigned to a lesser but still meaningful duties pending an investigation of wrongdoing by the employee, the employee who was paid in job classification upon reassignment had not suffered the loss of a clearly established property right in his employment. And I submit that for two separate reasons, there are a line of cases from this court that suggests that Mr. Atterbury had indeed suffered the deprivation of a property right. But to begin, it should be noted that this was not a temporary reassignment pending a disciplinary investigation. The investigation was concluded within several months of the reassignment by the summer of 2000, when Director Sherman concluded that Mr. Atterbury should be terminated.
Can I ask you, when you're talking about that, of what relevance is it that, at least as far as I can tell from this record, Mr. Atterbury was not given the real reason for his reassignment, that he was told, oh, we need more people to work on this investigative work. They didn't say, we're, you know, concerned about your behavior, et cetera, et cetera. It was not my understanding from the record that they did not tell him, frankly, this is why we're moving you.
That is correct. Not only did not tell him, that coupled with the fact that he had no opportunity, no forum, after his reassignment to respond to whatever the concerns were of the department. Certainly this was done for a disciplinary reason. He was deprived, in our judgment, of a property interest because the way reassignment can work in state government with a married employee.
Well, I understand that, but I just want to figure out, where's the legal relevance? How does the legal relevance of the fact that we're talking about plug into the analysis here, the fact that they were not candid with him about why they were reassigning him? To what issue is that relevant?
Well, I think that is a part, and a small part, of a much larger issue as to whether he was provided adequate post-deprivation process.
Does this lack of candidness show up in Loudermill or Gilbert or any of the other cases you can think of? Levenstein, for that matter?
The truthful answer is I'm not sure, Your Honor. And we're not here today only for the reason that they didn't tell him why they were doing it.
He did have gradually had things restored to him, such as being able to work from home and not having to report and getting a state vehicle, didn't he? And
gradually, eventually, at the very end of his work life with the department, that did occur as a result of a couple of grievances. But in our view, that was too little too late. And it was well after his reassignment in place.
What would be the motivation of not having these flex time or comp time records available to the auditor? Why does that make any difference to anybody?
We don't think that it did. It certainly didn't make any difference to the auditor. Mr. Atterbury gave a truthful answer as to why his unit did not maintain flex records. The auditors never found any issue of impropriety with his conduct.
He doesn't gain monetarily by that. What does he gain or lose by not having those records?
Nothing. But that was one of the bases for the department's efforts to discipline him.
Well, I understand that, but I
cannot answer why it was significant or why it motivated discipline.
Well, I thought you were saying, in the facts most favorable to Mr. Atterbury, that there's a legal difference between flex time and comp time, and he didn't know he was being asked for the comp time records when they said, we want your flex time records.
Well, that's really not very material to his due process claim. The only materiality it really has is that 20 minutes later, after that full-blown hearing, an administrative law judge of the Illinois Civil Service Commission concluded that there was nothing wrong in what he did. Our issue before this court doesn't turn on his guilt or innocence with respect to what happened in the internal audit, but rather how he was treated when he was reassigned and what he was not given. And if I may go back to the deprivation of a property interest within the context of qualified immunity, we relied upon two separate lines of cases. The first case was the Head case and the Swick case, which we believe stand for the proposition that a reassignment which might implicate future income or future career opportunities does constitute the deprivation of a property interest. And that's clearly what happened with Mr. Atterbury. This was not a temporary reassignment pending an investigation. The investigation was concluded 7 months before he went on his medical leave and almost 10 months before the department terminated his employment. Clearly, it implicated, and Judge Scott found that it implicated future employment because of the way state merit principles work. This court in Head determined, by citing both the holding and Swick, or what it felt was the holding and Swick, that the deprivation of a property interest could occur through actions which may not affect job pay or job classification but implicate future income, and that's the situation we have here. Now, conceitedly, Swick was decided after the reassignment. Head was decided after the reassignment, but was during the period of time Mr. Atterbury was in this procedural no man's land in his reassigned position. The Swift case was clearly decided 5 or 6 years prior to the reassignment. The other line of cases that we think are significant in this case are the Levenstein and Pratt cases. And while they may not be a factual mirror image of the situation Mr. Atterbury was confronted with, they certainly are parallel in the sense that an individual was reassigned from a position to a significantly lesser position, carrying the possibility that skills and prestige could be eroded and diminished and implicate his future employability. And that they were done under what might be characterized as punitive conditions. And finally, as a result of all of that, the employee was forced out of work, either for medical reasons, as was the case with Mr. Perot and Mr. Atterbury, or just giving up home and leaving, which was the case with Dr. Levenstein, and we believe and submit that those cases would have put the defendants on notice that what they did violated recognized law of this court. I am in my rebuttal time, and I would like to reserve time unless the court has other questions for me.
Thank you, Mr. Baker.
Thank you.
I often just wonder.
Good morning, Your Honors. This court should affirm the district court's decision at a minimum on a qualified immunity basis, because it certainly would not have been clear in these circumstances that Mr. Atterbury was being deprived of property in the first instance, and certainly, and also that he did not receive adequate procedures.
Ms. Wander, how could he possibly reach anything else? The district court denied summary judgment on the merits. And not only is a denial of summary judgment ordinarily not an appealable order because it's not final, but even if it were somehow appealable, you didn't take a cross appeal. You effectively lost on that part of the case, right?
Well, it comes up because the first part of a qualified immunity analysis is to look at whether a constitutional violation
right.
occurred in the first place.
And well, all I'm saying is the court is really against you on that point. And it's not the usual situation where you can say, well, you know, here's the ground that the court ruled on, and here are some other things that were properly presented that we can also urge in support of the judgment. The district court doesn't agree with your position. So it seems to me, at the posture we now have, it's qualified immunity or nothing.
As a matter of law, however, this court can find that no constitutional violation occurred and end the inquiry at that step. And I think that stage also has to be considered, and then we move to the qualified immunity. Clearly, qualified immunity is...
But all I'm saying is you're attacking, in this instance, the district court's judgment. You're not supporting it on the merits of the constitutional claim. Perhaps the bottom line of dismissal you're supporting.
Yes, we're saying that the district court was clearly correct with qualified immunity, but I think we can also raise in this court the alternative reason for affirmance, because this depends on the law and not any factual questions, that no constitutional violation occurred here in the first place. And if I may briefly address why that is so because to even get out of the box, to establish a deprivation of property, he had to show two things. He had to show that state law protected him against the challenged action, one, and he had to show some type of economic harm, which could include an identifiable impact on future benefits. And he doesn't get out of the box here because he doesn't show that he was deprived of any state law protections. He says he was demoted. And he was not demoted within the meaning of state law.
And how do you reconcile then, just let's say, Ferrat? That person wasn't demoted either. He kept his same title, kept his same salary. That just wrongly decided? Should we overrule it?
The person in Ferrat was found to be discharged. His state law protection was against discharge. Mr. Atterbury has never said, I've been discharged constructively within the meaning of state law. Had he intended to raise that claim, he could have brought an administrative proceeding before the Civil Service Commission and said, I've been discharged.
So your position is you could put somebody in a closet for the rest of their life and pay them their full salary and keep their title, and there's no... There's no implication for the job under state law?
No, my position is...
And that's what you just said, because that was your distinction of parent.
Here he has never raised a constructive discharge.
No, he's not. That's what I'm saying. So suppose we take the discharge away and you just put somebody in the closet for the rest of their life, and you pay them and you give them the job title, no claim. According to you?
First of all, that's not what happened here. There was a tremendous...
Well, he thought it was going to be forever, but...
There was a tremendous difference between the situation...
But could you just answer the legal question? Is there a legal claim under Illinois law for some hypothetical person, forget about Mr. Atterbury or anybody, who gets put in extremely demeaning circumstances, but keeps their job title and keeps their salary, and you say this is in perpetuity, you know, until you reach retirement age under state law?
That would have to be addressed under state laws.
Is there a claim in your view, or is there no claim? Either state law protects it or it doesn't.
If it qualified as a demotion or removal or a discharge, which is all...
That's the question I'm asking. Does it qualify? You know, if you had that
demand... That would be a question that the state court needed to decide. Here, we're not dealing...
No, we have to decide if it's a 1983 case. And I'm surprised that you're not just saying... Your position with Mr. Atterbury is putting him in the very lowest job classification that existed in this department and taking away quite a few of the advantages or accoutrements of the job didn't mean anything because he continued to have his salary and he continued to have his title. And so I'm just trying to find out, is that a general principle of law that you're urging for this court? That it's salary and title and salary and title only that matter in Illinois.
It matters in the sense that he was not demoted under Illinois law here. And
well, never mind. I understand that part of your position. I don't think you're answering my question, but you should just move on.
I wonder, would you spend a moment talking about the Head Swift case and what your position is with respect to them? Your opponent certainly lies for the case.
Yes. If it looks to whether a person was deprived of a property interest within the meaning of state law, Swift first finds that an officer is not, he was not suspended within the meaning of state law, and therefore he was not deprived of property. And then he goes on to look at whether there are any economic implications from... saying, well, even if he was deprived of property within the meaning of state law, we would have to then proceed to consider whether there were any economic implications, and that didn't occur here because just as it did not occur in this case, where there was no change to his job classification and no change to his salary. In Head is not helpful here because Head simply says, their property interest was implicated by virtue of a contract. And here it's not clear that the property interest is implicated in the first place because what he relied on was a demotion under state law. And
well, he was moved to a non-supervisory position, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
And doesn't that base hold... Motion to a non-supervisory position would adversely affect his upward mobility and in the future and thus income?
First of all, it suggests that that might occur. It doesn't decide the issue. It doesn't dicta whether this may be the case when someone who is permanently assigned is moved, that a property right, that there may be these future economic implications. But it doesn't... It's not instructive because it doesn't make a holding on that point. But it also doesn't reach the question of whether a property interest is implicated in the first place. If we just look at it as a straightforward qualified immunity question, what was before reasonable administrators, what they knew at that point was that a suspension with pay did not constitute a deprivation of property.
Ms. Winder, here's where I want to go back to my concern about the lack of candor. It seems to me if Mr. Atterbury had been told, we are transferring you to this other office and we're going to assign you to this other set of responsibilities because, frankly, we have a concern about your response to the auditors, and we think, you know, we've had these very serious allegations made by your assistant, and we have to investigate this. They would be in the position of, you know, people like Gilbert against Homar and others, he would know, well, instead of being suspended with pay and doing nothing, you know, and getting paid by the state of Illinois, the state is going to have him do something useful while this process goes on. But instead, he's given this song and dance about, oh, we need more people who investigate and this sort of thing. And there's a real lack of candor on the part of the state, which sounds to me like they knew perfectly well what they were doing wasn't appropriate, and so they tried to give him this cover story, and then he really just didn't buy it.
They told him that this was based on operational needs.
Exactly, which is funny. I mean, you know, it was clear that this other, that his assistant had come, Nancy Bouchon, or however she pronounces her name, and made these various serious allegations, and investigation had to take place. And it seems to me that the bare minimum, you know, why not tell a man this is what you're doing when the record post hoc really turns out that that's what they were doing?
Your question is about the legal relevance of that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm suggesting maybe part of the legal relevance is, you know, is this an indirect sign that a reasonable administrator in the state would have known at the time these events happened that this was illegal, that you had to give people some form of pre-deprivation process, and you had to give people, better, usually, post-deprivation process?
No, I don't believe that the fact that the reason was given is that this is for operational needs, and I think you have to take into consideration that...
Which was a lie, I mean, really. It was a lie.
There are concerns here about protecting those employees. I don't know that
that's not the operational need they meant.
As opposed to using the euphemism operational needs.
But they said we need people to work on this investigation. You know, what, I forget what, male investigators or some sort of investigators. That's the part that concerns me about the lack of candor. They didn't say we're trying to maintain morale in the enforcement administration unit.
That, the fact that they said operational needs has no legal relevance in this analysis. The analysis step one is whether he was deprived. Well, the constitutional analysis is step one. Whether he was deprived.
Now, I'm on step two of qualified immunity right at the moment. You know, if we agree with the district court that he's falling within Head and Borderline and Swift and all these other cases, and we're asking about whether something is clearly enough established that the reason that any reasonable public official should have known that it was there, it seems to me one could infer from the way they behaved that a reasonable person would know.
It doesn't affect the qualified immunity analysis, because at that juncture, I think it's appropriate to keep in mind that what does a reasonable administrator have before him? He sees their position is, we can move into this temporary assignment because we've looked at state law, and there's nothing in state law that precludes this temporary change of duties.
Well, why not tell them the truth? Why not say, we can move you, and we're moving you because these allegations, which they had met with him about, it's not like he didn't know that they knew. Why not be candid?
Perhaps they should have been, could have been, as a matter of employee relations. That does have no significance in the due process analysis. But they had before them, for looking at the perspective of a reasonable...
Well, let's just to be clear, your argument is it has no significance in the should you have known that what you were doing was wrong analysis.
Yes, that is.
That's what I'm questioning.
Their feeling was we are allowed to do this because this doesn't violate any state law protection. It's not a demotion, removal, discharge within the meaning of state law. He tests that out. He files a complaint with the Civil Service Commission.
Well, clearly, I mean, the runaround he got from them is impossible. Nobody ever listened until finally, you know, at the very end of the day, when he gets vindicated.
The Civil Service Commission made a finding in this case that he was not demoted within the meaning of state law. An administrator has that before them. They have a piece of paper from the Civil Service Commission saying, this is no demotion within the meaning of state law. A reasonable administrator would feel, oh, well, to the extent that there was any process implicated here, Mr. Atterbury used it. He complained to the commission saying there's been a violation of state law. The commission said, we find no violation of the code or rules.
So that takes me back to my other question. In other words, under the law of Illinois, you could lock somebody in a closet in a cellar for the last 15 years of his working life, and there's no process implicated, as long as you don't change their title and keep paying them the same amount of money.
It is likely that an Illinois court, or it's possible, certainly, that an Illinois court would say, no, you can't do that. But we just don't know what an Illinois court would say. Because he didn't, first of all, it didn't happen to him here.
But that's the implication of the argument. If it's conclusive that they say there's not been a demotion here despite the changes in what you're doing, then the concept of demotion is related only to title and pay.
The concept of demotion is only related to title and pay because it's a defined term under Illinois law. It protects you simply against changing your job classification. If I have one extra minute to just sum up, if we look at all the law, nothing put reasonable administrators on notice that what happened here, this temporary change in duties pending an investigation, would deprive Mr. Atterbury of due process. It's not like it's factually dissimilar from any of the cases. Thank you.
Can you reserve 4 minutes? Counsel for the state took an extra minute on our own, so you have 5 minutes.
Okay, I probably will not use all that time, but thank you, Your Honor. It's my understanding that the state in this case takes the position that there's no qualified immunity problem here because there was no deprivation of a property interest to begin with. And as I understand the argument, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, but as I think I understand it, she is saying that unless Mr. Atterbury had a remedy under state law to protest his reassignment, such as a appeal to the Civil Service Commission or agreements that he could pursue or an action in the circuit court, unless he had that type of remedy, he suffered no deprivation of property interest because he kept his job classification and he kept his wages. And I submit that would render never anyone having a due process claim because in those situations people would obviously attempt to exercise their state remedies as they properly should. In this case, it is clear that Mr. Atterbury had a property interest not only in a job, but in a position as a public service administrator. He was certified under Illinois law to hold that position. And it's my understanding of the law that has come from this court, beginning with Swift and going on to Wozniak, which was decided shortly after the incidents in this case, it's my understanding that there can be a property interest deprivation through a reassignment, even if it doesn't immediately affect wages or job classifications, or it can implicate either future income or the opportunity to advance professionally. And that's exactly what we have here. Mr. Atterbury was not given a short-term assignment. It was one that continued during the balance of his work life with the department. And if he had not gone on a medical leave, it would have gone on 14 months until the state got around to firing him. And during that time period, he ran the risk that his position could be reclassified through state process, which would implicate his income. He went on a medical leave and suffered a property loss, just like Officer Peratt. And the Pratt and Levenstein cases involve situations where there was a reassignment, and reassignments would not violate state law. In fact, Captain Peratt had a hearing in front of an arbitrator based upon a question of whether his collective bargaining rights were violated, and the arbitrator said that under the contract and under state law, he could be reassigned. I don't think that it's necessary to do any more than refer to my brief, but I think there is abundant law that Mr. Atterbury did have a property interest which was adversely implicated, and that the defendants at the time of the incidents at issue should have been aware of it. Unless the court has any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. The case will be taken under advisement.